Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, we have Jonathan Betts Saul, and his topic is storytelling, finding, adapting, and creating stories. Let's listen to Jonathan.
Good morning. My name is Jonathan Betts Saul, and I'm a whole bunch of things in my life, but one of them is a storyteller. A storyteller is part of my paid employment as a children's librarian for the Snow Isle Regional Library System, which is north of Seattle. And when we were thinking about coming to Holden, I thought, you know, what's the best thing I can present to the people of Holden? And one thing that I know quite a bit about from 15 years of training and experience is storytelling. And I thought, since a lot of what happens in religious settings is storytelling, just look at the Bible, it's almost all stories, especially the New Testament, it's almost all parables. If it isn't somebody doing something, that storytelling would be an appropriate thing to offer here. Obviously, people agree. What I'd like to do, as I say, I hope your left brains are awake, because there's a tremendous amount of material about storytelling. Most people have seen or heard it done or read it. Some people have a little experience with it, but I'm going to give you some what I think are some very valuable insights into it. But there, as I say, there's such a tremendous amount of material, I don't even know if I can do it in 2 hours. So we'll go over this outline, and then, you know, if there's time, we'll do some stories and maybe a song or two also. Okay. The way I conduct meetings in general, which is what I'd like to consider this one, just an information sharing meeting, is to start on introducing myself, which I just did, then do what we call an agenda review. An agenda review is where we go over all of the points that I intend to cover, make sure that I haven't missed anything that anybody came for. Okay, or if there's something you don't want to hear about, you can say it then too. So just real quickly, I'm going to give an overview of storytelling with some basic points. Why tell stories? Where stories came from? The types of stories that there are. And incidentally, these are mostly children's stories, because that's mostly what I know about. What makes a story good? Choosing the right story. This is totally, if there's one thing I want you to get from this, it's that part right here. RD, and that will extend over here onto the blackboard. That's why it's so expansive. This is the most important part of the whole thing. Then remembering existing stories, how to learn stories that exist. Okay. Then adapting existing stories, we can be real flexible with that. Creating your own stories, and there's so much of that I couldn't even write on the board. So we'll do an exercise, hoping that we have time. I have some more stuff to give you orally, but you'll each get a chance to create at least a nubbin of a story that you can then work with. Then we'll, if we have time, I'll tell you a story and you can analyze it using the framework I've given you. And then we'll have an evaluation. I'll ask you to tell me what you liked about the session and what I could do better for next time. So, how do you feel about the agenda? Will that work for everybody?
A+.
Okay, so is there anything on there?
It's about a week's instruction.
Right, is there anything on there that you would like to get that is, or anything not on there that you would like to get that is? Okay, thank you. So we'll go ahead. First, let me tell you that almost that the basic framework for this comes from this book, Creative Storytelling, Choosing, Inventing, Sharing Tales for Children by Jack McGuire. Now, I asked the bookstore to get this, and for some reason they weren't able to, so it isn't in the bookstore. But if you are interested in getting a copy, and if you're serious about storytelling, I suggest that you do get yourself a copy. You're welcome to come up and look at this, and I'll give you the vital information so you can either get it from a bookstore or from your local library. Since my library has it, I know you can get an interlibrary loan from us and from nobody else. Okay. I've color-coded things on the board. This won't show up on the tape, of course, but I'll try to emphasize them. Anything in blue is kind of a basic framework. Anything in orange is a direct quote from McGuire. Anything in red is kind of steps that you can take. Why tell stories? I just want to leave it with McGuire's quote. Storytelling transmits life-enhancing mental images from the teller to the listener. Okay. Now, there are other storytelling books like this one. Ruth Sawyer's The Way of the Storyteller is an extremely inspiring book. Another one I'd recommend for reading, but you don't necessarily need to buy this one because it's not so much a step-by-step kind of thing that you would want to use highlighter on and take notes in the pages and so on. But she actually uses stories to tell the story of storytelling. so it's really quite inspiring to read. And in fact, a lot of McGuire's historical information comes directly from her. I could really tell as I was reading the two of them, kind of like doing Bible study in some ways. Okay, Origins and Traditions, I'm just going to refer you to Sawyer and another author whose name is Marie Shedlock, S-H-E-D-L-O-C-K. Unfortunately, I don't remember the name of her book. The Sawyer one is called The Way of the Storyteller. I don't remember the name of Shedlock's book, but the two of them together are what beginning children's librarians are given to read about storytelling. So if you read those books, you will have the historical background. They go into the, you know, the Irish Shanachies and the Welsh Bards and medieval troubadours who roamed around Europe and all the things they went through. But in order to give you how to tell stories, I want to skip over that at this point. Types of stories. These are McGuire's types. First are the formula tales. These are stories that kind of play with words. Okay. And in fact, when we get to the example, I'll give you one of them. You'll see what it looks like. They tend to repeat. They tend to make for younger kids. Well, we'll get to that when we get to this part. Okay, fables and parables. Aesop's fables. Parables are in the Bible. You're familiar with that kind of thing. They make a point in very brief time, oftentimes using animals as characters or things that people won't immediately identify themselves with, but can kind of get the point if they think about it. So that's why I call them pithy points. It's not telling somebody, you do this because this. You know, it's a little story where they have to think about it a little bit, but it because it stimulates the mind, it's more fun than being yelled at. Okay, fairy tales, Cinderella, Beauty and the Beast, those kinds of things, magical changes. There's a fairy godparent in there somewhere. There's a beast who can make meals appear before you just by snapping fingers, that kind of thing. Magical changes are involved. Folk tales, on the other hand, mirror human behavior. Okay. Sometimes they're like extended fables, but a lot of folk tales, you'll see animals kind of behaving like people. A lot of the coyote stories from Native American literature. Those are folk tales. They mirror human behavior. They're much earthier, more realistic than fairy tales. In the library, sometimes they lump them together, folk and fairy tales, but they really are separate kinds of stories. Myths, on the other hand, embody the religious or philosophical beliefs of a culture. Okay. The Greek myths, they were not just pretty stories for people. They actually explained things for people. They showed people how to behave or not to behave. They showed them the follies of human character, that kind of thing. Okay, so we talk about myths as something bad. Myths are not bad. They're very important to any given culture. And you know, Americans have lots of myths too. George Washington chopping down the cherry tree. My father is a scholar of American history. He swears that never, ever happened. It was made up about 50 or 75 years after Washington died by this guy named Parson Weems, and he was using the incident as a teaching device, telling kids how to behave. You be honest, because George Washington was honest, the great hero of our country. You'll get the point, right? Okay. Legends. In some ways, those are close to myths, especially in America. We can see that pretty clearly. Well, the general characterization is they're exaggerated or modified historical facts. Okay, people like Paul Bunyan, for example, is an American legend. There actually was somebody named Jean-Paul Bonhomme, or something like that. He was a French-Canadian hero of rebellion against British rule, basically. But he was disguised as this big, strong, tough guy who could do almost anything. The French-Canadians would tell this story as their resistance to the British government in Canada. But then the story got transmitted through Maine and then through the American Midwest, essentially by an American advertising man from the lumber industry, who made up these tales as kind of glorified lumberjacks. And so that's how the stories that we know about Paul Bunyan came to be.
And then they gave him a blue ox.
And they gave him a blue ox, right. That was totally made up. But it was fun. You know, from there on, they were making a fun story out of it. But it started out with a little bit of historical fact and then got totally embellished. That is a legend. Realistic adventure is anything that could have happened. those oftentimes moral stories, like in sermons, some preacher's sermon will incorporate a realistic tale, something that either did happen or could have happened. If let's see, a week ago Sunday, when Martin Ames was preaching about this very moving incident that happened to him in Seattle, where he was getting food for this homeless woman, and she ended up acting like Jesus to him, basically. Very powerful stuff. That is a realistic adventure story.
Do you have a favorite?
I like them all.
For your own telling, do you have a, favorite?
I mostly do folk tales, but that's another story. What makes a story, but I'm trying to cover the generals at this point, go through as quick as I can, so then we can... I asked you to make mental notes at this point, anything that puzzles you, so we can get through this, and then come back and discuss anything that really strikes you. What makes a story good? It's news. There's some kind of tension or conflicting element within the story.
I'm not sure what you mean by news.
News?
Because I guess I'm thinking in terms of children, who want the same story over and over and over and
over again.
Right. That's a long way from news.
Okay, but it had to be a good story for them in the first place.
Okay, but that's why I question your...
Okay, but the first time you hear it, it's news. The first time you hear it, it's something new. It expands their mind just a little bit. That's why they like it. Each time they hear it, maybe they hear it a little differently, or they hear something they didn't hear before. Okay, but the first time they hear it, it's news. Now, adults have a much higher taste for novelty than children do. We don't need as much familiarity with the story. Although we do like familiar stories told over and over again, sometimes with a little different twist. And if we have time, I'll tell you Cinderella, which is a really fun version of Cinderella. But that's what we mean by news, is that it does have some element of novelty to it, something that expands your mind just a little bit, if only just a little bit. Sometimes it'll do a lot. Tension or conflicting elements are absolutely necessary. You need a sense of something happened in this story. It isn't just a word picture of a scene. Now, adults might tolerate a word picture of a scene. A lot of poetry is like that for adults. But for children, there has to be some kind of dramatic tension, especially as we'll see at certain ages. Action-oriented, same thing. It's pretty dull without some kind of action happening. And children especially need one action after another. Just one central action and everybody reacting to it, as many adult stories are. And it has a purpose. The purpose does not have to be explicit, doesn't have to be immoral, but there has to be a purpose for the storyteller in telling a story. You want to transmit an idea, you want the kids to have a good time, you want them to laugh in the case of a funny story. That's a purpose. I mean, it seems like much of one, but it is a purpose. So those are McGuire's four elements for story being good. I had never thought of it in that kind of depth, so I'm just relying on him. Now, choosing the right story. The very first thing you have to ask yourself is, did I enjoy this story? Would I enjoy telling it? Would I enjoy transmitting it? That's actually related to having a purpose. It might not be very pleasant for you to do. You might say some things that are hard on you yourself. But if it has enough of a purpose, then you could say, I enjoy it. It's doing what I want a story to do. Second, is it right for the audience? Age appropriateness. Most important, I'm still learning this lesson myself after 15 years. It's a big help for me to have to outline this whole thing. And again, this is from McGuire. Age appropriateness. From birth to 1.5 years, children sort of understand what you're saying, but you could tell them almost anything. What they love is the sound of your voice, the inflection, the emotion you're presenting. Okay, and you know how you would want to treat a child of that age. It's just a basic human characteristic that we want to be nice to children of this age. That you can tell them almost anything. You can sing to them. You can hum to them. I remember my mother singing me beautiful songs as a young child, and she swears she can never carry a tune. And if she asks me to sing today, it's true. She can't. But I remember these beautiful songs. But it was my mom, and she loved me. And that's what that's what gave me that perception. 1.5 to 2 years, stories need to be really simple. very, very simple things, like nursery rhymes. Many people think of Mother Goose as the prime source for nursery rhymes. I'm here to tell you that there really is a much broader repertoire available. A number of people over the years have taken those nursery rhymes and done interesting things with them. There's a, I'm sorry I didn't bring the citation, but there is a new updated version that I just got in the library a month ago that actually not only has feminist nursery rhymes in it, but they've taken a lot of the violence out or otherwise changed things around to make them much more acceptable to modern tastes. Okay. And for young children, those are good. One author I want to recommend in particular is Wendy Watson. Wendy Watson writes original nursery rhymes, and they're very sweet. They're really nice for young children of this age, so you don't want to be presenting a lot of heavy conflict to at any level. There are things like for dandling your child on your knee as you bounce them up and down, that kind of thing.
One of the things that concerns me as a teacher is that to a certain extent I want to get rid of the things that are I don't like, like Peter Pumpkin Eater is one that I don't like.
Right.
And I don't necessarily want the kids exposed to an awful lot of violence. At the same time, we're losing a connection that every child, when I was growing up, knew if I said Humpty Dumpty, how to go on.
Right.
Nowadays, that's not true.
Well, there's this concept of age appropriateness, and as we go through the different ages, I think you'll see that there are some ages where it's most appropriate to do those kinds of things to let the children, well, come to it. Okay, 3 to 5 years. He says chant-like word meditations. Now, I'm still not exactly clear what he means by that, so I'm going to have to go back and look at the book again. But I imagine that's things like what's playing with words, you know, making up almost nonsense rhymes as you go along. You see a stop sign, see stop, bop, cop, top, lop, you know, as you're running down the hill, something like that. Okay, 3 to 5 years. That's where you get the conventional plots, like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, that kind of thing. When you're using them with the children, you want to balance the familiar with the new. You know, like they say, for getting ready for a wedding, something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue, all those factors. I sometimes use that as a little mantra when I'm looking for my stories, because I try to pick the new books and also an old favorite or two. Something borrowed, to me, that means somebody else's story that I have adapted or picked up. A lot of my hand rhymes and games are borrowed that way. And something blue will make it colorful, you know. But does everything be black or white? But it is too soon for children to contemplate changes in character, situation, or attitude. Okay, things like Jack and the Beanstalk, you know, when the kid goes through all these big changes, you know, maybe it's a little too soon for them. My biggest problem in setting up story times for myself, this is where I'm learning myself, is that I often choose picture books that are too long for the kids, or there's too involved a plot. They can't follow it, they get bored. Now, I'm pretty good at doing stories aloud, as I think you've seen me in Narnia know that. You know, kids will follow along, even if according to this categorization, it's too advanced for those children. They will still follow along because they like the voice. I put a certain musicality into it. They like the fact that it really does move along. As I said, they really like the action as it goes along. But in developmental terms, if I really want to reach them most effectively, it's better to do shorter stories. When I've asked parents for feedback on my preschool story times, they've said, you know, that story was too long for my kids. They were weaving and moving around. That's an important message. I need to heed it. Okay, now 5 to 8 years, that's the golden years. Most picture books are written for ages 5 to 8. That's a problem for me because my preschool story times are 3 to 5 year olds. So I have to choose fairly carefully.
Well, may I throw one thing in?
Sure.
And it goes along with what you were talking about, the children. 3 to 5 year olds are very episodic. They cannot follow a story line at all. By the time children are getting to 5 and 8, that's when they can begin to say, now I can follow this happens, then this happens, then this happens. And I think that's important for people to know.
Great, thanks. Yeah, just to repeat for the tape, the point was as children get to be 5 years old, then they can follow a storyline more. As younger children, they're more episodic in their consciousness. They they can't really follow from one episode to another, right? Okay, now here's where you get the stories as what he calls a safe playground for threatening ideas. Things like Hansel and Gretel. Those kids are abandoned in the woods. Now, McGuire is saying, don't expose younger children at 5 years old to this idea because they'll be too scared. It'd be very hard to reassure them that this, you know, their parents are not really going to abandon them in the woods no matter what. The images that they get to work with exercise their mission. So this is where stories that are told in words, not necessarily with pictures, they can start to handle these. You can describe things verbally, and they'll be able to form a picture in their minds. And visualization is forming a picture in their minds. Conceptualization is being able to work with the idea of it, you know, kind of beyond the picture. Okay. Well, the idea of the wicked stepmother, taking them out into the woods, there's a visual picture you can have of that, and then the concept behind that is that, you know, she's been plotting against them. Okay, you wouldn't get that from a visual picture necessarily. Okay, and then the intricate plot patterns and symbolic rhymes inspire a search for coordinates and symmetries in the real world to help explain it. Now that is academic language, I know, but you can think about it. They work with all these elements of the story in their minds. Well-constructed stories will have a balance. They'll have the conflicting elements and also be balances of good and evil and various other kinds of balances. And this will inspire whoever's hearing that story. After they've heard the story, they have a chance to think about it. Maybe they'll see correspondences, things that are kind of like that in the real world. Say, I know my friend did a bad thing, but they're not a bad person. And they'll start to make that kind of connection, that there are balances in the world. There may be other kinds of patterns too. And then 8 to 12 year olds, they're much better able to understand the world with its complexities. Okay, they're moving ahead of their ability to deal with these complex issues, and they can handle more complex adventure stories, romances, intrigue type things, mysteries. Mystery stories start to become real popular about 8 or 9. And there's one author who kind of, let's see, what is her name? Levin. Elizabeth Levin, who writes these stories about these two girl detectives, and they're totally floppy basset hound. You can tell that this is for younger kids because of the way it's illustrated. There's not very many words on a given page, but they're starting to get. They're definitely mystery stories. The one girl detective who's always tapping her teeth. That's kind of her trademark. It's constantly gathering clues from all around her and kind of putting them together in a coherent picture. It's a model of how kids can start becoming detective stories. And there's enough cynical, not quite cynical, dry humor, I would call it. Dry humor in their observations, that kids can start to feel a little bit grown up because they've heard older people use this kind of humor and don't quite understand it yet. Here they're getting it all nicely illustrated for them. Okay, and in stories for them, you can start to explore magic, the limitations of magical powers. You know, a magician can do so much and no more. And inspiring heroines and heroes. This is where you can start to think about, you know, would I really be able to do anything like Paul Bunyan? Maybe I can. I know lumberjacks were kind of big and strong, and they, you know, they can really shove those logs around. They can't knock down 12 trees in a blow, but they kind of embody Paul Bunyan a little bit. You can kind of start to think of them as heroes in your life. And then 12 to 17, that's where you get back into serious self-definition again, as we did earlier with the 3 to 5s. 5 to 8s. And here they're looking for stories that they can kind of, with people that they can kind of identify with, even if they would never go through such a situation themselves, they can say, this could happen to me, I could be in this situation. Now, adult storytelling is a whole other topic, and I frankly don't know all that much about it, but this is kind of the characterization for telling the children. So what you need to do is know your audience when you're choosing your story, the audience you're going to be telling for. And as a children's librarian, it's my job to have enough stories to reach any of these groups, and we'll talk about that in a second now. I know that's a lot. Any questions at this point? People have asked some good ones already. Okay, let's go ahead. Culturally appropriate and situationally appropriate factors you need to consider. We're really going to talk about that some when we talk about adaptation. But I just want to mention them here because they fall in the framework at this point. It's real tricky stuff, kind of. Again, but again, you need to know who's in your audience. If you all know the kind of problems that might occur with culturally and situationally appropriate stories. Culturally appropriate stories is if there's anything that might offend somebody on like a cultural basis, or if they're just not going to understand.
And they're not familiar with it because it's not in their world.
Right, exactly.
Little Black Sambo.
Right. And situationally appropriate, that's...
Well, I was just going to say how tricky that is, because yes, there's been all this comment about The Lion King. Uh-huh. Now, that's not a movie I've seen, but apparently people are seeing things in it, all sorts of things.
All sorts of little resonances, yeah.
That they say are culturally and feminist, they're not good. And,
right.
And, other people are saying, hey, this is a great story, right? Knocking it.
Yeah. For those who don't know the reference, in The Lion King, the young boy is shown how to be a big, tough male, basically. And the feminists are objecting to that, saying, you don't necessarily want to be instructing young boys in this. And then some of the men's movement people are saying, well, maybe it's appropriate to act that way sometimes. So there's that kind of dialogue going back and forth. Situationally appropriate, what I mean there is, if somebody's just had a parent die, there are certain stories you don't want to tell, or there are certain stories you might want to tell, depending on which ones you actually have available. I recommend what I call a huge bag of tricks, so you will have resources on hand. But don't worry about having that before you start to tell, because you can't become a good teller without telling. So what you're aiming for is a big bag of tricks. You don't necessarily have to start out with one.
So John, by a big bag of tricks, do you mean lots of stories memorized?
Yeah, well, learned. In fact, Paul, thanks for bringing that up. We'll talk about memorization versus learning when we come to remembering. But yes, a big bag of tricks means that you have enough resources to handle any situation you're likely to encounter. So you're working towards that. You don't necessarily, please don't worry about starting out that way or you'll never get there. Sources. This is where this pile of books comes in. You can imagine at your local public library, there's likely to be an expert on storytelling, because that's one of the ways storytelling has been kept alive until the recent boom, the mid-70s, I think, is when it really got going. Before that, for years, radio and television had basically knocked out storytelling as a popular art. Okay, and only, in the last 75, 20 years, as it really started to come back again. Okay, creative storytelling here actually has some stories in the back that you can work with, kind of cut your teeth on. Here's one called Speaking in Stories, Resources for Christian Storytellers. This guy does a much gentler job of explaining things than McGuire does, but it's not as comprehensive. His name's William White. This came from the whole library. I've recommended a couple books for the bookstore that they did manage to get in. One of them is Spinning Tales, Weaving Hope, Stories for Peace, Justice, and the Environment. This is collected by a group in New England called Storytellers for World Change. It's only, I think, $23 paperback. Fairly stiff, but it's worth it. It's really worth it. If you're doing any kind of teaching with kids, these are really fabulous resources to have. Unfortunately, the cover on the bookstore edition is blue, so don't look for a black cover. It's blue on the newer printings. But they are exactly the same stories. This one is Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart, Parables of the Spiritual Path from Around the World. And these are actually for people who see themselves on a spiritual path. Teenagers actually might get quite a bit out of this. Some of the stories are kind of long, but there aren't many little short ones that you really have a good time with. So these two are in the bookstore. here's an example of a library book, The Green Man. I've told this story a couple times to the Narnia kids, and I think once to a group in here, too. This is a picture story. See the pictures? See how much text is on the page there? This is too long for 3 to 5-year-olds, basically. And it was obvious when I was telling it to the Narnia kids. If I had really dramatized it up some, thrown in a few more action type of actions, they wouldn't have sat still for very long. But it really is a fabulous story of a guy coming to appreciate the simple things in life. Just an example of the kinds of things you can find in my library, in a library. That one, unfortunately, is out of print, but there are lots and lots and lots of other ones. Many of the best ones, here's my favorite genre is the folk tales. Many of the best ones are folk tales because they tend to be very action-oriented as opposed to literary, where there's a lot of language play. A lot of ideas being played with folk tales are really action, one after another.
Name some.
Jack and Beanstalk, one thing after another. Let's see. Well, there's Cinderella.
Would the lad who went to the North Wind be?
Yeah. I mean, he's on the quest. That's a very important one. Arrow to the Sun, I think, yesterday for the preschoolers. Only because they'd heard it before did they politely sit still. That one actually has not very much on each page, but it's definitely a transformation story. The boy is virgin birth, actually. He's sired by the sun. Although the other boys taunt him, so he goes on a quest to find his father. First he goes to various people on Earth to help him find his father. Finally, nobody will even talk to him. Finally, the arrow maker still doesn't talk to him, but turns him into an arrow, sends him back to the sun again, then the sun puts him through 4 tests. You know, the magic number 4 in Native American culture. Puts him through 4 tests, and he sends him into 4 kivas, which mirror what they actually do in the Hopi initiation ceremonies. And then when he comes out, he acknowledges him as his son, sends him back to Earth with his spiritual message. That's classic, one thing after another. That's the kind of thing I mean. Okay, other sources, teachers. Many teachers are good sources of stories. Either school teachers of children or people who teach storytelling. And there, at least in the big cities, there are quite a number now. Seattle has quite a few associations. We have Seattle Storytellers Guild. I'm sorry to bring the address, but it is available.
My friend is a member of a Story League.
Yes, the National Story League, too. That's an older organization. It's been around for a long time. It's just not as widely known as... the Seattle Storytellers Guild is an affiliate of what used to be called, National Association for the Preservation and Perpetuation of Storytelling, or NAPS. But just this year, they changed its name. It's now called the National Storytelling Association. Much easier to remember. And again, your local library will have the address for that. It's in Jonesboro, Tennessee, at their headquarters. They have a number of affiliates around the country. I don't know whether this one in Minneapolis. There must be. I know there's storytellers there. And certainly Seattle is. Seattle, Tacoma is a big stronghold for storytellers, I would say. Friends and family. Friends and family can be a real good source for ideas for stories, which you can then either remember, adapt, or create. We'll go through those procedures. TV. Now, believe it or not, TV shows can sometimes get you going on stories. TV shows usually are, most at least TV shows that we kind of stereotype about are very shock oriented. But they all tell stories, otherwise they wouldn't put them on. They have to tell a story in order to sell to advertisers who pay the money to put them on screen. And the advertisers want people to watch, so they try to come up with the most compelling stories they can. So sometimes you can take a TV story and turn it into a tellable story. I've never done it myself, but I have seen it done. Star Trek actually is quite a source for some tellers. And then books, and I just mentioned some of the books that I brought along. Incidentally, I just want to mention that Jack McGuire, who wrote the book that I mostly use, also wrote this book, which I've never seen anywhere but Holden. Whole library called What Does Childhood Taste Like? And this has a number of activities for developing your creativity. There are a number of other books that have good exercises too, but I was just browsing through the library and came across this one and thought you'd like to know about this too.
Is it
for adults?
Yes, this is for adults. I imagine you could adapt the activities for children, but you know, have to play with it some more. We only had this a couple days. Okay, now, somebody mentioned memorizing stories. Very important concept here. A distinction that McGuire doesn't make, but I would make, is the difference between literary stories and folk stories. Literary stories, you know, are composed by somebody that we know of. Folk stories go through what's called a folk process, where one person tells it, somebody else remembers it, and maybe tells it a little bit differently. And then another person tells it differently, and another person tells it differently. That's called the folk process. Happens a lot in music too, right? Maybe some of your songs have been processed already. So, a literary story. In a literary story, the author has used words in a certain way for a certain purpose. That makes it important to memorize their story and tell it just the way they told it. Folk stories, as I say, are more action-oriented. It doesn't matter so much exactly how much or in what way you describe the action. It's the content of the action and the effect of the action, and people's reactions to the action that make a difference. Okay, everybody get that distinction? Okay. So the way that I talk about remembering existing stories is based on folk tales. It's not based on literary things. Literary things, you do have to memorize, and that's much harder. It's really difficult. I stay away from it, frankly. Every time I've tried to do it, it's been really hard. I did it once for a Hans Christian Andersen festival, where I tried to show how an American storyteller was trying to imitate Hans Christian Andersen in kind of the spirit of the way he did things, but I'm not going to do that for you here because it would take too long. Okay, the first, again, you notice in orange there, this is a McGuire quote. Learning a story is being certain you can make your way from one landmark to another. That's another very important point I want you to remember. All you need to do in telling a story is get from each landmark to the next one. And so what you're going to be doing when you're learning the story is learning those landmarks. Okay, and then your natural powers that you've developed will allow you to get from one each landmark to the next one. To learn a story is what McGuire calls the five reading method. Did I write too small?
No, I have to move because the light's right in the middle. Put glare on it.
Okay, there's the five reading method. First time, you read all the way through the story for enjoyment. Just enjoy the story. You want to make sure you do enjoy it so it will be worth telling. Okay? We talked about enjoyment before. Second time you read for what we call character study. You look at each character in the story. Sometimes there's only one or two. In the case of the Green Man, there's basically one character. And you analyze what happens to that character throughout the story. First of all, what kind of person is this? What is their situation? And then how do they show their character through their actions in the story? I didn't say it anywhere out there, but it's much better to characterize characters by their actions than by describing them as a wicked person. You know, they have, in the story, they can't just be called wicked, they have to do something wicked. Very Quakerly concept for us Quakers. third reading is for catchwords or transition phrases. Some stories, especially folk stories, will have words that repeat every time. There'll be a little magic phrase that somebody uses. Or just the way things are described in the story. Maybe it's a cat, which I do a lot for preschoolers. This is a good example. It goes, hundreds of cats, thousands of cats, millions and billions and trillions of cats. All I have to do is remember that and remember in what context it occurs each time. And the story is just a snap once you've read it two or three times. Fourth time is for environment or setting. But be sure to put the story in its appropriate environment so it makes sense. Okay. So the fourth time you're reading through, you're looking for details of the setting or elements of the setting, not necessarily the specific details, because those are modifiable later. And the fifth time you're reading through for reassurance, that's to make sure you have all those things down. Okay. Now, when I learn a story, I usually have to do those five things only once, but that comes with experience. Okay, I've done it a lot. Your first time, second time, third time, you might have to run through those five steps a couple times. Don't worry about it, okay? just kind of follow the sequence. Don't worry about how many times you have to do them. Just remember the five steps, and you'll be fine.
Well, John, what if it's a really long story, or you don't have time to read it five times, or 10 times, or whatever?
This, for just starting out, don't choose long ones. Okay. For just starting out, take your time. You know, do it when you do have time. Okay. If your life is really pressured, you know, remember this is something that's going to help your life. Put a priority on it. Okay. If you can. Put the highest priority you can on it, because it's going to enhance your life. If a large part of your life is related to younger people, especially, you know, this is a major enhancement of your ability to relate to them. If I had a chance to talk more on why tell stories, I would have gone into that some more. Does that answer your question now? More or less?
Sort of.
Okay, we can talk more later. Okay, and then he has an association technique for remembering those elements, and it's basically, quoted. Okay, 2,400 years ago, a tragic event on the Greek island of Ceos inspired the famous orator Simonides to invent a memory technique that storytellers have used for centuries to remember their tales. One evening, while Simonides was attending a banquet, a devastating earthquake struck. He survived unharmed, but many of the guests still reclining at the table were crushed to death beneath heavy stones and mutilated beyond recognition. Simonides was the only one who could identify the corpses because he happened to recall which couch each person had been occupying. The experience was naturally quite upsetting to Simonides, but in true Greek fashion, he abstracted a general principle from what had occurred, namely, that memory works by association, and that one can create associations to strengthen specific memories. So the first step is to envision each of the main chronological events of the story, that is, each action as it happens, in the form of a separate, concrete visual image. Okay. Then the storyteller takes the first image and mentally attaches it to a specific place in a familiar room. Using this as a beginning point, he or she continues around the room, distributing the images in a succession of particularly memorable places. Okay. You can almost imagine it as setting up an Easter egg hunt. Later, when the storyteller is actually relating the story, he or she can remember its main events in the proper order by taking a mental walk around the room and re-visualizing each image in turn. So you've set up the Easter egg hunt, then you go around and find them again. And then he gives an example. But does everybody get the point? Okay. Now, rehearsal. Another critical place. I should have put it in orange or something. Forest de Gaulle green. Rehearse. Now, I always rehearse each story at least 5 times. Okay. And in fact, when somebody asks me, you know, how much time does it take to get ready for a story time, I'd say it takes 5 times as long as the story hour. That's my general formula. Sometimes it takes less if I already know the stories. But I try to do at least 5 rehearsals for each event. Again, it's a public performance. If you're talking with a child, you know, with a single child, it's different. But this is the rehearsal method. Once you've been through the 5 reading method already, now you tell it aloud, or at least mentally aloud. Mumble if you need to. Don't peek at the words, okay? Because what you're doing, you're just sharing it with one listener. You don't have to be letter perfect on these words at all, okay? Don't stop and don't race through it. Don't stop and try to remember. Don't race through it and try to get through it as quick as you can. Recreate the essence of the tale. What was the story really about? Just make sure you've conveyed that the very best you can with what you already remember. Now, if you're not satisfied with the way that you've done it, read it again. Okay. Focus on the elements you want not to forget. You've got the rest of them. Just focus on the elements that you want to be sure not to forget. Then tell it again to reassure yourself. Always end by with a success. I see puzzled looks.
Do you ever tape it? When you're rehearsing, do you ever tape it?
I don't, but other people do. I can pretty well tell what I'm doing. But some people do that. They, you know, I don't like the sound of my own voice on tape. I'm not going to listen to this tape either. but I don't feel like I need to. But it's a fine technique to do, by all means. Was there another question? Do we have one? Okay. And four, take notes in writing. I did this for years, and I've not done it too much in later years. I'm just kind of lazy, I suppose. But it is a good idea. Just make little, you can make little note cards for yourself. Some people do it on sheets, like songwriters do when they write down their songs. Just an outline of the story, just enough so you will remember how kind of how it goes, the landmarks. You know, the Easter eggs around the room. So be sure to write down the name of the story and any place that you got it. So if you really need to go back, you can. Okay. But then just the basic elements as you need them. If there's anything really fun about the story, like some of these catch words, you know, that you want to be sure that you remember, be sure to note them down too. Okay. I'm working pretty well. Okay, adapting. This comes with observation and practice. You can actually adapt any time, but you'll feel more confident about it after you've told stories that you've learned in this way for a while. And I have another McGuire quote. Respect the essence of the story, what it means to you, what you like about it, and preserve the fundamental elements that give it its special quality. The overall plot, the major characters, the general environment. Now this is going to, you notice it's going to allow you to change some of the details. And again, major points. Stick to the original sequence of major plot elements. And I think I will do Cinderella for you. I think we'll have time for that.
John.
Yes.
What if one of the things is the thing that you want to adapt?
Well, the major plot element is just that. You know, something major happens.
What if you want to use, like, a totally different main character? So that you can tell the different ways that people might react.
Okay, well then, you're starting to make up a new story then. Yeah, because if people are going to react differently, different things are going to happen, that's a different story now. You'll see, I'm going to do Cinderella and you'll see what happens. Avoid making the story more difficult to understand. This is a real trick with some of these adaptations. You'll see that in Cinderella when I do it. And enlarge on the action rather than the description. Okay, so if you need to make the action clearer, if you need to make things clearer, make things happen through action rather than description. Okay. And then we talk about creating your own. But you guys have asked enough of the kind of questions that show me that I need to tell you a story now. So this is the story of Cinderella. And this is from a picture book, which I didn't bring. The pictures are really priceless, so I recommend you look this up when you get home. I believe the author's name is Ellen Jackson. Cinderella, two words, P-D-N-A. Once upon a time, they were two girls who lived next door to each other. You may have heard of one of them. Her name was Cinderella. All day long, Cinderella worked so hard, slaving away for her two wicked stepsisters and her cruel stepmother. When Cinderella was through with her daily duties, she would just sit down in the cinders of the fire and feel sorry for herself, thinking about all the terrible things she'd had to do that day. But next door lived another girl whose name was Cinderella. Now, Cinderella also had two wicked stepsisters and a cruel stepmother, and she had to work just as hard, doing all the chores for them and picking up after them. But Cinderella whistled while she worked, and when she was through with her chores for her family, she went out and cleaned the parrot cages for the next door neighbors at $1.50 an hour, and she earned even more extra money going out and mowing lawns. Well. She had tried sitting in the cinders a few times, but it seemed like a silly way to spend time. And besides, it only made her clothes sooty and dirty. Well, one day, the king of the land announced that his sons were ready for marriage, and he was going to throw a grand ball so they could meet all the women of the kingdom. So all the young and married girls of the kingdom got themselves ready. Cinderella's sisters, as I'm sure you know the story, just commanded Cinderella around, making her new dress, making their new dresses and getting them all ready and cleaning them up. And when everything was done, they drove off to the ball, leaving Cinderella sitting in her cinders in tears. Cinderella also had to get her sisters ready for the ball. They were so excited and jumping up and down and everything. When they left, Cinderella went and got all the money that she'd saved up from doing those chores and picked up the dress she'd put away on layaway for just such an occasion. Cinderella sat in her cinders weeping, crying, "Oh, if only I had a beautiful dress, I could go to the ball too." Well, Cinderella, of course, had a fairy godmother who happened to be passing by at that moment. She heard Cinderella's wish. Poof, Cinderella was dressed in a beautiful gown. "But fairy godmother, how will I get to the ball?" The fairy godmother was a little put out that her goddaughter couldn't seem to figure anything out for herself. But she waved her magic wand again. Pumpkin turned into coach. White mice turned into horses. Passing rat turned into coachman. Meanwhile, Cinderella took the bus. And in the book, there's a picture of her reading a book to the child in the seat next to her. Now, of course, Cinderella was the most beautiful girl in the whole world, even totally covered with cinders. So when she got to the ball, all the men, especially Prince Rupert, Prince Randolph, the king's son, came rushing over to her and were just fawning all over her and wondering who this beautiful girl was. And of course, Randolph, being the prince, got to dance with her the most. Cinderella was nothing much to look at, but she was spunky and smart. She knew some great jokes, including one about an anteater from Afghanistan. When she got to the ball, it was Randolph's princely, she went straight to the punch bowl and poured herself a glass of punch. Well, Randolph's princely duty was to greet everyone who came in, so he went over to greet her. And Cinderella said, "Well, what's it like being a prince?" She was trying to make conversation. "Oh, it's just wonderful," said the prince. "All I have to do is ride around the kingdom all day looking proud and noble and review my father's troops as they rock by, as they march by the reviewing stand." And he turned his head so that Cinderella could see his right profile, which was his most attractive one. "Boring," thought Cinderella. Just then, a little Tweety-looking man came up from behind saying, "Excuse me, we recycle plastic around here." And Cinderella promptly handed him her cup. "Who are you?" she said. And Randolph said, "Oh, that's just my little brother, Rudolph. He's not a prince. He doesn't act like a prince at all. He runs a recycling plant and also manages the home for orphaned kittens." Well, Cinderella and Rudolph hit it off right away. Rudolph had asked her to dance, and they did all kinds of fun dances. But when Randolph asked Cinderella to dance again, she could hardly move because she was wearing those teeny glass slippers, and she was afraid that they would break under her weight. So all she could do was kind of sway to the music a little bit. After they were all tired up from dancing, Cinderella and Randolph found themselves in deep in conversation about gum wrappers, rusty tin cans, and getting the knots out of kittens' fur, when all of a sudden, the clock started to strike midnight. Oh, the spell wears off at midnight," screamed Cinderella, and she ran for the door. Oh, the bus has stopped running at midnight," screamed Cinderella, and she ran for the door. "Stop, wait," cried the two princes and ran after them. But they were in such a hurry that they ran smack dab into each other. Bam! On the palace steps and fell down. When they picked themselves up, Rudolph found that his glasses had smashed on the pavement, and he couldn't see a thing, but he felt around and found two shoes, a scuffed up old loafer, and a little glass slipper. He picked them up and said, "These should definitely be recycled." "Oh no," said Randolph. "That's how we're going to find these girls. They got away from us. But I'll never find mine unless I have her shoe." And Rudolph said, "You mean you didn't think to ask her name?" "My lover's name is Edna. So, but come on, let's go look them up and see if we can find them. But Randolph toddled off to sleep to get his beauty sleep and put his plan into action in the morning. So the next morning, Randolph went out with a glass slipper and tried it on the foot of every unmarried woman in the kingdom. He went all the way around the kingdom and just could not find his bride until he came to Cinderella's house. He tried the shoe on the stepsisters, and it just didn't work. But then he saw somebody sitting in the corner who looked vaguely familiar. So he went over to her. "Would you like to try this on, miss?" And of course, it fit perfectly. "My love," he cried, and he swept her up into his arms and took her back to the castle so they could be married. Meanwhile, Rudolph was running around the kingdom, looking up every Edna he could find. He went through all the plain Ednas, and then he started going down all the Ednas with Cinder before their names. And finally, he came to Cinder Edna's house, and he said, and all the stepsisters wanted to try on the loafer, but he wouldn't let them because they weren't named Edna. So finally Cinder Edna came in from mowing the lawn, and when Rudolph looked up, he could hardly see her because he'd lost his glasses, and she looked like a big plate of mashed potatoes. But he agreed to let her try on the shoe, and he said, "Are you Ashes Edna?" No, wait, that's not right, because he'd already been through all the other Ednas. Cinder Edna. Yes, that's me. Well, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to mention the detail. In the conversation they'd had, he found out that she knew 15 ways to cook tuna casserole. One of the things he learned from doing all that housework. He'd gone around asking everybody if they knew how many recipes of tuna casserole they knew, and had never found anyone who knew more than 7. "Of course I know 15, said Cinderella. So she rattled them off, and she got down to number 14, the tuna casserole with pickled pig's feet. But she just could not remember that 15th one. "Oh, well," she said, I may not know 15 recipes for tuna casserole, but I do know a joke about the alligator from Antarctica." "My love," shouted Rudolph, and swept her up in his arms, and he swept her back to the palace so they could be married. And so they had a grand double ceremony. And both the girls dropped the cinder from their names, so it was Ella and Edna getting married. Well, they soon found out what married life was like with the prince. All Ella ever got to do was sit around in the throne room watching her husband review the troops, listening to reports from the Undersecretary of Underwear and ministerial legations from the ambassador from Lithuania. While Cinderella, while Edna, for her part, lived out back and started studying for a degree in waste management engineering. And at night, and caring for the orphan kittens, and at night, she and Rupert played their favorite games, enjoyed tuna casserole, and shared their favorite jokes. And guess which one lived happily ever after?
Oh, that's a great